Welcome back to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. I'm Catherine Hastings. Tonight's program features an interview with poet Bruce Snyder. He is the author of Paradise, Indiana. Also, a number of poets will read from the new anthology, Everything Indicates, Baybridge Poems and Portraits. This is a celebration of the new East Span of the Bay Bridge. Before we move to those features, though, here is Lawrence Ferlinghetti reading from his book, A Far Rockaway of the Heart.
Wearing a Polonaire's derby, I am in a Zeppelin with 100 dignitaries in tailcoats from all over the world, cruising about looking for a place to declare peace, personal and universal, looking for a soft landing for peace on Earth. Gardens are sighted on the horizon, and the airship veers in that direction, only to discover there is no airfield, and we veer off again. The sky is lit with flares. A man in tails with wings jumps off the Eiffel Tower, thinking he's a bird. He plummets straight down in front of his friends. I am a boy picking petals off a sunflower in Provence. It's midsummer. A million crickets sound their huge drone in the night. A sunflower leans in a window where I am a boy leaning out. Lulu, Lulu, someone calls. I have picked all the petals. They fall. Lulu, who is here? It is hot in the dark room. There are riots in France and Italy. The Americans killed Sacco and Vanzetti. I saw Lindbergh land. The Zeppelin sails on. There is jazz on the wireless. It's Sidney Bechet, Paris, 1930s. The dignitaries toasting each other in champagne and American cigarettes. The pilot sends a Morse code greeting to a ship at sea. The band plays on. The captain sends back a round of drinks on the house, sailing through the hot night, an endless flight around the world. We gaze out the portals of the crystal gondola at the endless stars. Night reveals the cities of Earth lit with leftover sun. The dirigible soars in the summit of heaven. Where will it all end? The eternal pilot pours over the charts. The dawn is pointing. On a lake far below, the wood boats knock together. Life sails on. The Zeppelin flies on into the 21st century. The Zeppelin is life itself. The zone we fly through, endless, without borders, without boundaries. There are no more nations. Migrant populations sweep the earth in search of food and shelter. We throw down our champagne glasses. The TV shows the endless night sky. We are watching an eclipse. The universe, endless, stretches away in endless night. There must be a place where all is light. Where then, O endless one, in endless eternity? Where now? We are all heavenly bodies, wrapped in time, hurtling through bent space. Flameouts illuminate the landscape.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My guest today is Bruce Snyder. That's S-N-I-D-E-R. He's the author of The Year We Studied Women, which won the Felix Pollack Prize from the University of Wisconsin Press, and most recently, Paradise, Indiana, winner of the Lena Miles Weaver Todd Poetry Prize. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Snyder is a former Wallace Stegner Fellow and the recipient of a James A. Michener Fellowship, and teaches at Stanford University. Welcome, Bruce.
Well, thank you, Catherine. It's really great to be here.
The first thing I want to do is to congratulate you on winning this prize. I know there's a lot of competition out there.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, you know, as any poet knows, it's sort of brutal out there to get a book taken these days.
Absolutely. Yeah. And especially, I think, in a contest situation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'm going to want to talk to you, obviously, about your latest collection, Paradise, Indiana. But let's start by hearing you read the opening poem.
Sure. The opening poem is a poem called Map, And for any listeners you have out there that aren't familiar with, this is a particular form called the guzzle, which is a series of couplets that has a repeated end word or end phrase. And the poem ends with a couplet in which the poet must work his or her name into it, so that as a kind of signature. So when you hear me say my name, you'll know I'm coming to the end. So map. There ought to be a fire somewhere in Indiana, not this night across the fields in Indiana. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God said, let there be corn, and there was Indiana. I kiss my love, taking his hand near the deer stand. Honey is fragrant on the table, and there is thunder in Indiana. And what of Amy Blaine, who drowned when she was 12? Nights I feel her in the cold rain of Indiana. For the rest of my life, I'll feel the wet hair plastered to her face. I'll feel darkness and the magpie's feathers in Indiana. But I'm not interested in grief, just the sound of the yellow throat, just the warblers in the thickets of Muncie, Indiana. I don't need a communion wafer. I need the autumn mist of Indiana. Arcola, Goshen, Napanee, remember a place where the river bank passes through you, where the Amish girls spread their skirts in Indiana. Remember a place where spring breaks the yellow news of the pawpaw tree, where a pan of grease hisses against a flame called Indiana. Lord, the boys touch other boys, eating fried dough and glazed apples, lips sticky with syrup and heat in Indiana. Each winter, sleet turns the cornfield into a cemetery. Its epitaph reads, Indiana. My father's pulse slows between systole and diastole, between the frozen creek beds and the grain silos of Indiana. And you will ask, where are the lilacs? And I will answer, under the snows of Indiana. Soon spring buds will thrust their sex organs into the mouths of bees. Their story is the story of Indiana. If there are 100 ways to recall the dogwood in bloom, this is the one where your parents make love on a battered sofa in Indiana. Stamen and pistil, pollen in the air, the field of poppies knows lust, spells its name, Indiana. What's death, after all, if not the Wabash wearing down river stones, if not the muskrat flicking its damp tail in Indiana? Are those angels' trumpets? Is that God calling Bruce? Have I reached the end of the world or Indiana?
Oh, thank you so much. That poem is just such a phenomenal way to open the book. It's like an overture of what's to come. And the form accomplishes so many things. It keeps us rooted in place right there in Indiana. We're not going to forget where we are. It sounds a little bit like a religious incantation.
Oh, thanks.
You know, a calling forth.
Uh-huh.
And it also, at least it made me feel like the poet you is a bit haunted by this place. Is this why you chose this form in particular?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think that sense of the haunting is part of what. And I'd written so much of the book is narrative and tells these little stories and little scenes. And I really wanted a poem that opened in a very different way, that had a kind of more of a sweeping kind of series of brush strokes across this sense of place, and to maybe kind of even foreshadow in the poem a bit of what the book would touch on in different ways.
Right, and it does exactly that. Like I said, it has that kind of religious feel. There's that echo in there. There's humor in it, too. And God said, let there be corn, and there was Indiana. That is so great.
Yeah,
but there's danger in it. Uh-huh. I kiss my love, taking his hand by the deer stand. That deer stand, a place where animals and nature, they're obliterated, right? They're killed there.
Right.
And in fact, we're given a metaphor for homoerotic love near the end of the poem. Soon spring buds will thrust their sex organs into the mouths of bees. Their story is the story of Indiana. It's just, It's just a great opening. And you have those questions in the ultimate stanza. Have I reached the ends of the world or Indiana? Is that a question you can answer?
Yeah, can I answer that? Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure. Is that an answerable question? I don't know.
Right.
Yeah,
I don't think it is.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to give away too much in the beginning here. So let's start slowly revealing the identity of Nick, who shows up in so many of the poems throughout the collection. We know by page 7 that he's dead and that he died very young. He was 17. Would you go ahead and read at these speeds?
Sure. And this is what I think of this as the first of the Nick poems, really. Mm-hmm. It's the third poem in the book. At these speeds, for Nick, 1971-19 to 1988. He saved for months, mowing lawns, taking extra shifts at the Dairy Queen. And when finally he brought it home, I helped him swirling rags, polishing until the hubcap shone, the tires special ordered to fit. Easy ride, he'd say, slamming the brakes, his big joke. Instrument panel lighting the glove box filled with the manual's sweet talk. Fuel injector, carburetor, exhaust manifold. So when the call came, I couldn't help but wonder if he'd planned it all along. The shut garage, engine idling, sunglasses slung from the mirror. On the passenger side, a schoolbook lay open, chewed gum on the seat. For months, I pictured each moment before and after the men left. The sirens faded, the car now parked, sitting motionless, a proud animal crouched in the long grass, as if it knew one day it would take me too, driving into some starless night, leather cold against my skin. But how could I imagine such travel, knowing only the grief of it, which held me as it must have held him, engine quivering, headlights filling the dark, ordinary garage. One sudden brilliance, then the next.
So the effect that reading this poem had on me was, first of all, I really cared about Nick. I cared about you. And it started playing with my head a little bit, you know, just wondering, okay, who is he? You know, who is he? And then you move on in the book, and the next poem that really struck me as far as answering that question is called Romance. And I still don't want to say exactly who he is yet, but let's continue and hear Romance.
Sure. So, Romance, and this is in two parts. So, Romance 1. Grandma Cream's butter tends the crippled chicken in the cardboard box. They nearly pecked it to death. Nick and I wrestle, practice the tomahawk chop and the Indian deathlock, her stuffed pet squirrel looking past us to Roosevelt on the wall, to her shelf of romance novels, Tender Midnight, Passion's Daughter, Love Evermore. In the sink, a gutted pig sags, its back flank sliced for beans and noodles. She moves hymnals, a wedding photo, Grandma in her one good dress, Grandpa square-jawed in his Sunday suit. He was so handsome back then. Her government check tucked in her Bible, she hands me one bullet. Go get me a rabbit. 2. In the back acre we pick apples, throw them one by one. I miss. Nick, you couldn't find your ass with both hands and a banjo. The asthma comes, his Adam's apple swims, inhaler in hand he turns, his breath the parakeet's molting dust. In the coop, we freshen a fouled pan. I love the smell of gasoline when shirtless he drives the combine. In a pasture staked nearby, the new Guernsey catches little girl's scent. Aroused, it pushes hard. We watch the bull lick her, its jerky mounting. It snorts. White semen strings run the udder's length. Grandpa, smiling, slaps her flank. Bullseye.
That's such a great ending. Oh, my God. So after the poem you read previously, At These Speeds, There was a poem called Afterlife, a title which shows up over and over again in the book, which is phenomenal. It does something else that maybe we'll have a chance to talk about. And in that poem, Afterlife, Nick pulls you into a shanty. And, you know, it gets sexual. And after reading that poem, I wasn't quite sure now, is this a good thing, a bad thing? Was it consensual? What was it? And then we read romance and it's like, ah, okay, this is young love. This is adolescent love. We have adolescent gay love. We have homophobia. We have internalized homophobia. And we start thinking that the suicide is a result of this. But it gets even more complicated than that. And I still don't want to say why. We'll get there in just a minute. But, you know, it was painful for you. Nick had to go through giving the appearance of being straight. And you had to watch him doing this with his girlfriend. This is, you know, probably not real uncommon with adolescent boys. And you had to do a good amount of acting yourself. I was wondering if you would read a couple of poems that deal with this. At Floyd's Tuxedo Shop.
Sure.
And then The Girlfriend.
Sure. Sure. So this is At Floyd's Tuxedo Shop. Flipping me off, Nick smiles in the mirror, his front tooth chipped where the shredder kicked back. Cufflinks, forest green cummerbunds, everything chosen to match our dates. Monkey suits, Aunt Star called them the week before, handing him a pack of rubbers. I don't want no grandkids. For days we've been mocking the box, laughing lubricant, spermicidal. Inside the shop, mannequins' blank faces stare from displays. Handsome men in tuxes lean toward us the way, each spring, cherry trees bend, cripples by years of pruning, an answer to ripening heat. I'll kiss at prom Cindy Slater, hoping Nick will see us, and later tell the guys in gym she smells like the science lab. But today, Nick and I help each other undress, unbuttoning to reveal a glimpse of freckled chest, trail of hair at the waistline. Back at the car, he laughs, blowing up rubbers between us, filling them with his breath. As we drive, he chucks them one by one out the window, pale balloons trailing behind us, mile after quivering mile. And then this is The Girlfriend. She calls him Nicky. She twirls her hair with one finger. When she gets a crucifix ankle tattoo, she says, it's for Jesus. When she gets a B in geometry, she cries. In her father's apartment above the filling station, the smell of oil rags mixes with the tangerine lotion she rubs on her legs. At the wake, everyone will say how hard it is to watch her stand with Aunt Star weeping over the casket. She'll collapse outside the funeral home, then speak at the school memorial, wearing a bracelet she's woven from his hair. Teachers will shake their heads, such a tragedy for a young girl. That spring, she'll date a guy on the basketball team. Drinking boons, they'll park at Milford's Quarry, cranking the radio in her brother's truck. They'll talk for hours. They'll make out. When I pass her at school, I'll pretend I don't see her. Along Route 9, corn will rise again in the fields. The leaves will bud as they always bud. After the rains, tent caterpillars will fill the trees like snow. Webbed and resinous, they'll cover entire limbs, multiplying as they feed. A strange white silence. Even kerosene can't kill.
Have you given many readings out in the world from the book?
I've given just a few. Just a couple.
And when you read this poem, I can imagine that you have people coming up to you saying that they have this experience in their own past.
It's interesting. To be honest, I haven't read that poem at a reading yet. It's always interesting to decide what, you know, I'm going to read.
Yeah.
But I haven't, so I haven't had that experience. But I'm sure, you know, I have no doubt people have had that experience.
Yeah, plenty. So this is just one of the poems where we see Nick, not just as your lover, but you talk about the aunt and the aunt is telling Nick how to behave as if the aunt is his mother. So, in fact, it turns out Nick is your cousin.
Yeah.
Right? So, complicated.
Yeah.
Complicated.
Complicated.
So, Nick committed suicide. How did you make it through? And, I mean, there was no such thing then as the It Gets Better campaign.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk a minute about, you know, the whole relationship, him being your cousin, you ended up being lovers.
Sure.
He kills himself. I mean,
yeah.
Go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the character of Nick in the book is based in part on my cousin and is based in part on, you know, and it's parts of details of the character are actually drawn from another cousin of mine, too, who died in a car accident. So he's kind of a conflation in ways of two deaths. But, you know, he is based on a cousin that when I was, you know, in my early teens that I had a relationship with that was as it was in that time. I mean, this was the, you know, the mid-80s. In rural America, rural Indiana, yeah. where it wasn't something that we talked about, really. I mean, it was something that
no
happened.
No kidding, yeah.
But it was for me, I think, you know, it was a first love for me. It was a strange, absolutely. Confusing, complicated experience. And when he died, it was, you know, the hardest thing, I think in many ways for me, the book was, you know, in writing the book, it was really writing about, as much as it was about death or grief, it was about silence is this, this, you know, the poem ends with this idea of silence and that sense of a grief that you really can't speak really.
Right. Yeah. It had to be the whole relationship had to be such a secret for several reasons, you know, we'll just call it society
yes.
right now.
Yes.
And yeah, I mean, it's clear that this wasn't just about two young boys finding lust. There was
right.
real love there.
Yeah.
You know, the love comes through the poems. And it was very circumstantial because of where you are and what was available and everything.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I'm yeah. glad that you say that. I mean, because I think they're elegies, but and somebody said this to me the other day that they read the books and they said, you know, they thought of them really as a series of love poems. And I was really glad to hear that because for me, that in many ways, that is what
really
they are.
Yeah, that really comes through big time, which is beautiful. There's a poem that takes place a week before Nick's death, The Ambiguity of Stone. Would you read that one?
Sure, sure. The Ambiguity of Stone. I want to believe the last time I saw him, no language was needed between us. A dive lure flaring like a tiny orange flame between rubber night crawlers as a breath from my mouth entered his. Frost had taken the ground the week before. Everything seemed ready to harden or split wide. Tractor parts lodged in stiff dirt, the mulberry sap clogged by cold. Even now I want to believe eternity exists, in that corner of the lake where we once saw Bobby Gary take a BB in the eye, where cattails forked in summer, and on our last afternoon, Nick leaned to bait his hook. A week later, he'd be dead. In the woods, I'd find a bike so honeycombed with hornet nests, I could taste their wings in my chest. The whole sky would quiver, power lines cross-hatching clouds as if someone had stitched them with a lightning hum. But that last day, everything went quiet. Pounding out dents in the shanty, we talked of smallmouth jigs and where the bluegills might bed in the spring. We cast our lines, gutting a trout that spilled its clutch of eggs, until the last sun sank over us, the way it sinks over quarry stone, ready to be made into church steps or garden statuary. So that even as we packed up our things, something inside him waited to emerge, as a flock of starlings made a shadow of his face. The cold night swallowing old rowboats, on a shoreline it had already erased.
So you live in San Francisco now.
Yes.
Yay.
Yay.
Could these poems have been written if you were still living in Indiana, or did they require distance?
It's funny. They did. I think they really required distance, you know. I mean, because I think there's a certain point where that landscape becomes also part of my imagination, right? It becomes mm-hmm. kind of mythic for me. It lives in that way. And once it takes on that kind of, you know, status in my mind, I feel like I can really write about it then. Mm-hmm. When it's too real around me, it's harder for some reason.
Yeah. I totally understand that, how that happens. So I mentioned earlier that there are a number of poems titled Afterlife sprinkled throughout the book. And I'd like it if you'd read the last one.
Sure.
And if you want to talk for a minute about how you chose to sprinkle afterlife throughout, that's fine.
Yeah. Well, this was a series of poems I wrote. It was one of the later things I wrote for the book because I realized at a certain point that I didn't feel like I had poems in which the speaker was mourning Nick in the present, mm-hmm. in the present of the moment. It always was sort of retrospective. And so I wanted to write a little bit about that strange experience. I think if you've ever lost anyone, where every day you seem to wake again and rediscover the loss, mm-hmm. and the way that someone's absence in the landscape makes you feel or miss their presence more somehow, right? Like it's sort of mm-hmm. characterizing Nick a little bit in sort of presence through absence. So I was mm-hmm. interested in this sort of mix of things. And
also, you know, when I was reading these poems called Afterlife, it was definitely about Nick, but it was about you too.
Yeah.
All kinds of afterlife going
yeah,
on here.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And for me, the book is so much too. It's about grief. It's about mm-hmm. the way it plays out and mm-hmm. all these, different elements of it. So this is the last of the Afterlife poems, Afterlife. It takes both hands to unfix the spike he drove into the fence post, worrying dirt loose from around its base. A spider spins the ache in my throat. If he were here, what would he be doing? I torch a phone book, watching the names and numbers burn. I feel the fallen phone line, the horned lark crushed in the mailbox's rusty throat. Weevils become the dreamwork of fields, the old shack set back in the tree line. I'm tired of the corn, their fibrous heads. I'm tired of the white cocoon in the old jam jar, the fruit bat brimming with darkness. Barbed wire, concrete slab, slag in the rusty water. I walk the yard of Holsteins, dewlaps quivering, nerves pulsing in the udders. 2 miles away, the Walmart is going in, barns giving way to Pizza Hut, Penguin Point. I look across the silent field. The plow is hard. My heart is hard. Dirt, distance, it does not end.
Powerful stuff. Thank you. How would you like to end with the last poem of the book? We'll fade off into that silence
you were
talking about.
Absolutely. And this is, this is from where I come from. I grew up hunting and learning.
This
to
one
hunt.
Was a little hard for me to read, I confess.
I grew up hunting. So this was a sort of daily a sort of natural part of my childhood. So, and it's called Gutting the Whitetail. Having shot it, we must clean it. We are shaking with our good fortune. Our hands numb from cold, we roll the carcass onto its back. The belly is soft. It is snowing. We've never done this before, but we've seen it done. While I spread the hind legs, Nick guts breastbone to tail. Like butter, he jokes, moving slowly, avoiding the paunch and intestines, holding them away from the knife. Okay, he says, why did the farmer name his pig Ink? He slits around the anus, drawing it up into the body. Why, I ask. He imitates a drum roll. It kept running out of the pen. Gathering the ropey mass, he rolls the stomach out onto the frozen ground. The rest comes quickly, liver, diaphragm, the pelvic bones quick crack. With a heave, he splits the breast, pulling gullet, lungs, heart. By now he's out of breath. We flip the body belly down, blood pools spreading out like roads on a map. We know not to break the bladder. We know how quickly the intestines sour. We high-five, passing a cigarette as the body cools. We are alone together. He is alive. We watch the windpipe steaming in the snow.
Gorgeous.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure.
And this is Catherine Hastings. You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. And this segment of tonight's program is a celebration of a new book out called Everything Indicates, Baybridge Poems and Portraits. And I have one of the editors here, Tamsin Smith. And Tamsin, can you tell us a little bit about how this book came to life?
Well, it was really the product of great friends gathering over food and wine and poetry. Alyssa Perry, Ben Davis, and I had started just gathering up friends and also strangers to meet and share verses, to write a little and read a little. And I think it was a second or third dinner, we had the notion of expanding the circle and gathering up a bunch of poets to take a tour of the new eastern span of the Bay Bridge. And we all got out there, and this book is the product of where we went with that.
How many poets took the tour of the bridge?
I think we had about 25.
That's a good number.
Yes, and from all throughout the whole Bay Area, it was a wonderfully diverse, eclectic group.
And I was so happy to be one of them because the tour was phenomenal, starting out with Bart Ney's talk.
Absolutely.
And then he drove us out to the site, and we got to go on a boat under the bridge and then got to walk all over the top of the eastern span, watching the construction workers.
The introduction with Bart, I think, was really a critical point because when you understand all of the effort, the engineering, the imagination, the human will that went into, has gone into, and is continuing to go into constructing that, it brings it to life in a way that's completely inspiring. Mm-hmm. And it's there right in front of us. We just don't pay attention to it usually.
That's right. It's a construction
Or we drive
project.
Over it. That's right.
Yeah. And it's the largest construction project in the world right now.
Yes, and of a particular kind of engineering, this idea of a self-anchoring suspension bridge is pretty cool and a wonderful poetic metaphor, which a lot of the writers picked up in their pieces.
And our San Francisco Bay is so beautiful, and I have to say that this new eastern span is just adding to its beauty.
Absolutely.
It's gorgeous. So I know that this book was initially published by Words, Pictures, Ideas, and I understand that now Heyday Books, which publishes a lot of historical books from California, is publishing it.
They're distributing it for us, which is an incredible honor. The long legacy of Heyday Publications is is a real jewel in the crown for our state. I'd encourage anybody to dip into their portfolio. So for us, it was an absolute thrill that they were willing to take us on and help get us into local bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
And
I hope the California History Museum will carry this book, too.
Well,
we should
give them a ring and make sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. And where can people go online, perhaps, to find a copy of Everything Indicates?
There's a link to the Heyday. You can go on to the Heyday press site and order it through there. Or if you just want to go to everythingindicates.com, www.everythingindicates.com, you'll find a link to the order form. You can order one or as many as you like.
I'm going to ask you one more question because I know there's a new project coming up called Pie in the Sky.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Pie in the Sky is going to be this amazing art installation that Ben Davis has put together where the numbers, or the first 1,000 numbers of Pi, this infinite sequence, will be written in the sky. Skywriting, and the letter, the numbers will be very, very tall. We'll begin, I think, in the South Bay, loop all the way around the entire Bay Area, and like so much in life, these amazing, majestical numbers will vanish almost as soon as they're visible, and we are going to need a much broader community of support to help us capture that moment in words, in images. So we have a Facebook page and Twitter feed. We would love to encourage everybody to have a viewing party and respond as you see fit. And we're going to collect and curate and hopefully turn this into the next iteration of Everything Indicates as a sort of verses and visions of the random and infinite, which should be a lot of fun. Pie in the Sky will get written probably between September 12th and the 16th, Mother Nature permitting. We're looking for a clear day, but we'd love for people to keep in touch with that and pray for no fog.
Okay, good. Well, good luck with that. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
So let's hear some of the poems from Everything Indicates Now. This is just a small handful of the poets whose work appears in this book. We'll start with Jack Pitts.
Hi, my name is Jack Pitts, and I'm going to read my poem called The Beating Bridge. It's hard to bestow grace notes of admiration, let alone awe, in a rampant age. You have to make exceptions for hummingbirds, of course, with their mosso revolutions and fluorescent whirls and otherworldly vibrations, most of all for their literal hearts, which dwarf ours. Here on the recent edge, education and limited history clash to produce our beloved fissions of turbulent idealism. I observe and participate while clarity fractures and suffers, and the lies, taints, hypes, dismays, doubts are assigned and become everywhere expected. I can't help it. And yet I watch agape as our new bridge of steel and cement and skin, blood, bone, mind, and who knows what exotic global minerals slowly take shape. Oh yes, it's designed with due regard for the inevitable deadly vibrato. Okay, phew, thank you. But for now, its construction proceeds. Will it make it in time? I see it deeply rooted, connect, rise, connect some more, and rise again, regulating freshly disjointed sunlight across my altered bay, establishing a new eon of water rhythms of light and shadow. Will their patterns really be set in and by this stone for 150 years? I am not wary. Handsome, high, staunch, and graceful, its particular shade of white a nod to the partner gulls. For now, awesome and admirable are each easily bestowed. As gift, it's half unwrapped and tantalizing. As metaphor or simile, it's premature and compelling. Vibratory, visceral, vast as a hummingbird's heart.
Aja Kushwa Duncan, and I'll be reading The Span. Spanning the milky green waters of the bay, moving between here and there, yesterday and tomorrow. In between is not present but emptiness, what is crossed and recrossed, what becomes forgotten. The bay was bridged in 1936, stitching land together with suspension and truss cantilever. Almost 100 years later, it is to be done again. Everything is to be done again, piece by piece. You, too, are restitching the same wound, moving back and forth across the puckered skin, like sentences repeating the unnecessary syntax, like love. What to do with all the extra nouns? This body once belonged to someone else. This wrist, this arm once connected you to another. The bridge can hear each mile that it crosses. Spanning one of the most seismically active regions in the world, it listens for every sigh and groan. The initial pilings were Douglas fir, clusters of trees banded together like straw on a broom and plunged into the mud. A century later, they are to be replaced with braided steel. The metal is deaf, but it can feel the shifting layers of sediment. When the fault ruptures, it will thrust the earth forward. But it is the steel that will torque and scream. Secondary effects are often more traumatic than the first. What comes after the initial rupture? You were together and then you were split in two. There is no feat of engineering that can suture you back. Beneath the bridge lives a flock of cormorants. During the morning's commute, while the cars head west into the city, the birds fight east en masse to their fishing site. Within an hour, there are hundreds of dark-winged birds swimming in rows, nearly half of them submerged in the silty water. They dive into an estuary phosphorescent with pollution, seeking their waning silver fish. You have stopped breeding. An entire generation forgot to remake itself. Each span is linked by Yerba Buena Island. The bridge tunnels through. Next to the island sits another, a landfill built for the 1939 World's Fair. Treasure Island is a fictional place, a landing strip for Pan American Airways flying boats, the first planes to provide commercial air service from San Francisco to the Philippines. This was before the Second World War, when Manila would see 10% of its population murdered, most of the city burned. The flying boats died too, crashing 1 month before in Trinidad. Neither the passengers nor the crew survived. There is risk in any connection, to cross sky and water, to link that which has always been apart. After the initial stitching heals, there is a violent cleaving, to begin and end with injury, to break open and closed. This emptiness, this accretion. The falcons roost in the metal beams of the eastern span. Once cliff dwellers, they have adapted to modernity, to the human tendency to scrape the sky. The new bridge will have a self-anchoring suspension tower, a 500-foot white blade rising out of the sea. The tower is autonomous, manifest, tethering heaven to earth. Once the sections of bridge are replaced, the falcons will abandon their nests. Biologists in their white suits will foster their eggs, feed their young, release whoever survives into the wild. What wilderness remains is the untamed expanse of the mind. You are tethered here, someplace between memory and fantasy, yesterday and tomorrow. Your heart, the dark mess of it, is home to every fledgling. On the eastern edge is the construction site. Unlike the bridge, it is a temporary structure. At the entrance is a small exhibit of objects found during the reconstruction of the bridge. There is a glass case. Resting on black felt are two millennia of human objects, a bottle of bourbon, a pill case, the missing buttons of someone's shirt. Such are the things that people carry and lose. On the right side of the case are the older objects, the arrowheads and obsidian skinning knives, the pestles for grinding nuts and seeds. But the most beautiful object of all is a sweat scraper, an elk bone tool curved like the hand to scrape sweat from flesh. The handle is crested with abalone beads, adorned for the monumental effort of lifting the past, its excrement, from the surface of skin. The bridge is twinned, past and present structures resting side by side. Soon the old will be removed and only the new structure will remain. But for now there is a window into everything you have been, everything you are becoming. You are cantilever and truss, one arm parallel to the other. Bridge this emptiness. Cross the hungry expanse.
I'm Kevin Simmons. The shapes of things for the New Bay Bridge and those who build it. It's softer than you think. Temperatures were raised, yes, to forge the pieces, but even they have lovely names, like catenary curve and cable saddles, and others could be called bracelet, wing, echoing pressure, freighted steel fit for horizon, such distances already traveled like that and this, the 1,000 miles and tens of 1,000 miles, the 1,000 hands and, you understand. The Japanese, hard hat at all, the Dutch and British, conservatives and cyclists, Italians and homeschoolers, freethinkers and Koreans, conservationalists in Chinese, and more Chinese, spans even wider than those, reaching all who take into themselves through the O of their mouths, the O's of their nostrils, oxygen, then sound or sigh. Here again are the shapes of things, repeated geometries of the animate and inanimate. But no matter the final shape, in this case, bracelet, wing, echoing pressure, all, every, each, circle, circle, circle.
Tamsin Smith, Ode Abridged. I begin with a reference to Shelley's Ode to the West Wind. Make me thy lyre, even as the forest is. Fog veiled, I could be a wind-strung harp laid down by a luminous god. Soul spine cresting a chorus of waves for the pleasure of mortals awed. Here in these notes a wanted reprise, your melody buckled to mine, our everest wish for spirits that soar, wide-winged with an ache sublime. No fault nor tremor can break the flight of a free form tethered in air. Give a sign, cast a line, an oar, a shore, a dare. Join rock-socket soul to sheer-link dream. In union we meet our test. Move through my islands, arise and come. Be transported, thy east upon my west. This wandering verse may time traverse. Let first feelings whisper true. For all we can claim of an anchor in life is a sea-sifted pas de deux.
Ben Davis, not a metaphor. I am the thing that I am, nothing more. I'm not a metaphor, dear poet. I'm a bridge. I exist to connect communities, to facilitate human mobility, to provide safe passage. There is no need to look any deeper. My meaning is clear. This is our truest measure. If you want to know who you are, don't look for meaning among your greatest notion. You are only that which you do. Yes, I am a bridge, dear poet. I bring people together. I span a harsh divide. What is it again that you do? I do not stand for some thing. I stand because I was built to stand, or perhaps withstand a force beyond all reckoning. Yet I once fell. I am only humans, the culmination of a nation's steely imagination made real by the actions of a great many who became that which they did. I am life's lasting reminder, one generation's great gift to the next. Between you, you created me. I am hard proof of civilization. I am your greatest intentions. I am your shared desire, your desire to share. I am your love for one another. It is you that am I.
This is Catherine Hastings, and I'll be reading two poems from Everything Indicates. A note here before I read the first poem. The word engineer is from the Latin root ingenium, meaning cleverness. And Yemanja in the Yoruba religion is the ocean, in essence of motherhood and a protector of children. Ingenium for Bart Ney, East Span, San Francisco, Oakland, Bay Bridge. Over the bay's wind-blossomed body, a soaring of light and motion, newborn might made of dreams and well-worn knees. The sky casts off her old gray dress for a plume, blithe and mad with beauty, a cool white life wrapped in silver air. Behold the sleek rachis rising on the backbone, its white veins agleam in Oakland's lovely eye. Breath of Yemanja brushes through, brushes through. How quickly this bridge becomes a part of it all, mingles with the flow, the sails below, the breeze wandering along its piers, pursues its flight into clear Elysian atmosphere. Muse, lyre, feather and wing, raised to our eyes you bring radiance. Hold us in your elegant arms, carry us over the world solidly, no sudden gaps to mind, no trap doors. No trolls, just angels, thick as undersky, here on the inland sea. This poem is a haiku sequence. Swan Bridge. I feel prouder to live in the East Bay. Overheard poet touring construction of the new Eastern Span, San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, April 6, 2011. On the old East Span, a small troll stands riveted. On the new span, us. Some words tossed around, pinnacle of seismic calm, backbone of the state. Between the clear hills, pale as the moon, it rises, sweeps up from the shore. Her beautiful shape, parabolic curves and wings, scale the upward sky. A white swan feather floats disconnected from earth, pearl horizon. Before you can reach the lustrous light of Oakland, you know you've arrived. A cloud torn from sky, engineered into a bridge, inspires angels. And that will conclude tonight's program on Everything Indicates Bay Bridge Poems and Portraits. I do want to mention one other person involved with this book, and that is a photographer by the name of Thomas Michael Alleman, A-L-L-E-M-A-N. He just has some amazingly beautiful portraits of the construction site in this book. They're all black and white photographs, and they are stunning. Thanks to all of the poets who were able to come in to record their poems tonight. And I hope you'll check the book out. You can find it at Heyday Books. Okay, here is a little music that goes with this, a little bit. It's called The Bridge. It's from Joe Jackson's album, Heaven and Hell.
Your heat.
That was Joe Jackson's The Bridge. We have a few minutes left tonight, so let's listen to Robert Lowell reading The Skunk Hour.
Nautilus Island's hermit heiress still lives through winter in her Spartan cottage. Her sheep still graze above the sea. Her son's a bishop. Her farmer is first selectman in our village. She's in her dotage. Thirsting for the hierarchic privacy of Queen Victoria's century, she buys up all the eyesores facing her shore and lets them fall. The season's ill. We've lost our summer millionaire who seemed to leap from an L.L. Bean catalog. His nine-knot yawl was auctioned off to lobstermen. A red fox stain covers Blue Hill. And now our fairy decorator brightens his shop for fall. His fish nets filled with orange cork, oranges, cobbler's bench and all. There is no money in his work. He'd rather marry. One dark night, my Tudor Ford climbed the hill skull. I watched for love cars. Lights turned down, they lay together hull to hull. Where the graveyard shelves on the town. My mind's not right. A car radio bleats, love, oh, careless love. I hear my ill spirit sob in each blood cell as if my hand were at its throat. I myself am hell. Nobody's here. Only skunks that search in the moonlight for a bite to eat. They marched on their souls up Main Street. White stripes, moon-struck eyes, red fire, under the chalk, dry, and spire of the Trinitarian Church. I stand on top of our back steps and breathe the rich air. A mother skunk with her column of kittens swills the garbage pail. She jabs her wedge head in a cup of sour cream, drops her ostrich tail, and will not scare.
This is Catherine Hastings. You've been listening to Word Temple. If you have any questions or comments about tonight's program, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.